start down the list. We're actually going to have Barbara Jensen come up and talk about the spirit of 45. We normally have the vice chair do that, but we don't want the vice chair to take Barbara's thunder, so we're going to have her give us a little report, after which I will walk through with people what is transpiring today. There's a full room, and most of you are going to be witnesses.
Not quite. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Barbara Jensen. I spent a few years in this capital before I retired from state government, and I was before you 4 years ago this very day, actually, the 18th of April, 2003, to legislate the Spirit of 45 Day, which is a day that recognizes the World War II generation for all they've done for us and their values. You have testimony in your notebooks. I'm not going to read that. You can read that later. There are a couple messages in that communication of two pages. Yeah. One is, make sure we celebrate that day, second Sunday of every August. It was congressionally endorsed in 2010, and you legislated the day in 2013, this very Senate committee. And the other is trying to obtain the photos of our World War II veterans. 152,000 served in Oregon, 16.1 million served in America. In less than a four-year period of time, we lost 500,000 people. And in Oregon, about 4,000 that are listed on our World War II Memorial Wall. We had a chance to talk about a special day today, the Doolittle Raiders anniversary, 75 years ago, and we were able to embrace that idea and address the Senate this morning. And we've got a video to show you that's about 10 or 12 minutes about the program, and then we'll close it up with any Q&A.
The spirit of 45, born at December dawn. The spirit of 45, the legacy lives on. Let the youth of tomorrow keep the spirit alive. So never forget the spirit of 45.
My dad was a very down-to-earth man. Growing up, he didn't even speak about his actions in the war. I really didn't know anything about it until I was in high school. I mean, he's just down-to-earth about everything. The medal was in the drawer. It wasn't in a case. It wasn't anything he was displaying to the world. He wore it with pride when he wore it, but he definitely would be thinking, this was so nice to represent all those people that were with him during that time. I'm able to keep my dad's story alive. It's been a while since I've talked about him at a function. He's been gone since 2005. To me, this is just a little piece of getting his story out there again and people thinking about him and keeping his memory alive. I love it.
My grandfather's name is Daniel Thornburg Griffin, and he was 30 years old when he was serving at Kaneohe Bay, and when the attack happened on December 7th, 1941, it's believed that he was the first man killed in the attack on the island. Those losses that occurred were not for just some little meaning. They have big meaning, and that they impact generations. You know, my dad was affected by it. He really took that to heart and never graduated from high school, got his GED, and ended up moving forward and served 20 years in the Navy, and then served 20 years for the gas company, and taught all of his kids the value of hard work. And I'm a doctor at Kaiser Permanente. I have a brother who's an engineer. I have another brother who's a PhD professor at University of Virginia. And I have a sister who works in the software industry. So people who, by many words, would be described as successful. But I think ultimately it came from these values and issues that are talked about with integrity and honesty and hard work.
I have this opportunity not only to honor all the veterans of that era, but to honor my father. He served in New Guinea as a truck driver, and he came back, and he was one of the veterans who came back to help rebuild America after that. A lot of our veterans that are buried here are World War II veterans, and we have to honor them on a daily basis. But just having an understanding that from this day forward, for the next 5 years, every day is going to represent a 75th anniversary of the war. 75 years ago, we weren't even thinking about a war. Mm-hmm. And then after, you know, Pearl Harbor, we were in it, you know, and everybody was affected. As one of the wars, probably the last war, that everybody was personally affected, either through sacrifices at home, sacrifices for their loved one in the war, or sacrifices for being in the war itself.
There's a hero, a soldier, a man or woman who's given their life for our country, for our freedom. God bring them home safe this time.
My mom is from England. She lived through the bombing and the Blitz of London. She met my dad on a dance floor in 1944. They were married in 1945. She sails over in 1948 on a cracked troop ship just before they get to Ellis Island. She's got $10, but she makes it all the way to Salem, Oregon.
I had written stories of my life, and I decided when I was 87 that I would put them all together into a book. And it involved us with the Spirit of 45 and with the National War Brides Association. It's necessary for the younger generation to learn more about what happens in this world. And to me, they are the people that are going to run our country in a few years. And if they don't pay attention to what has happened in the past, they will be unexpected about the future. And we need them to learn about the different feelings in different countries.
Her DNA, the person that she is, I think I inherited some of that. I didn't really ask for this job. It came to me. The greatest generation is slipping away from us. We're not going to have them around. We want our communities and our families to send their photos in. Their photos of World War II heroes. The ones that inspire us. The ones that we remember. The ones that we talk about with our children.
And send a copy of that photo to us. Basically, upload it to our website. Give us an opportunity to take that photo, put it into a template that we ultimately want to contribute to the National Spirit of 45 organization and be part of a national wall of honor.
On the Washington, D.C. Mall, in 2020, August, Victory in Japan Day, 75th anniversary, Spirit of 45 Day, we will have a banner from the Capitol steps of the nation to the Lincoln Memorial, back to the reflecting pool of the National World War II Memorial.
So volunteers, yes, we need people. But in addition to that, we need donations. All of the money goes to the organization. We don't have a paid staff, but what we do need is funding so that we can take the photos, create the posters, we can have the ceremonies that allow us to continue to get the word out to others.
We need the support of everyone out there. If you have a grandparent who lived through that war, we need you here to show your support for their sacrifices they made for us.
Well, I'm hoping he would be proud that I'm here doing this, so thank you.
I got a new life, and I have enjoyed it. It's been great working with the Spirit of 45.
So I never forget the Spirit of 45. So I never forget the Spirit of 1945.
So this is about remembering. It's about being inspired, inspiring our future generations to ensure those values stay with us. In the audience is my 92-year-old mother behind me here. She was here testifying 4 years ago as well, along with a 13-year-old who still continues to talk about World War II and get her peers to subscribe to those values. I appreciate the time to tell you about this, and hopefully Senator Boquist and I have been talking about a communication that would go out to the constituents about this initiative. Today is Doolittle Raider Day, but it's really about honoring them on the second Sunday of every August when we commemorate that day that you legislated, and about a photo that becomes the memorial on the 75th in the nation's capital, where we will cover 2.3 miles of that mall, and I hope a lot of Oregonians.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair.
And I tried to write down because my dad's a World War II vet. He passed away in 2008, but he's at Willamette.
You know, oh, nice.
National Cemetery, but it was www.OregonSpirit45.org. Is that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson.
Download the pictures to that?
Yes. On the back of your bookmark, you should have a bookmark at your desk.
Oh, yeah.
Look at the back, and that's the website. 3,000 of those will be handed out at Memorial Day at the Willamette National Cemetery. We're in partnership with George Allen there at Willamette. They want to do this for at least 5 years through 2020, and they intend to promote the Spirit of 45 along with other events as appropriate.
Great. Thank you.
Make sure. We'll be watching for your photo.
Okay.
Thank you. Charles, anything? Thank you, Barbara. Thank
okay.
you very much. Thank you for all the hard work.
Yes, thank you very much. And I hope that some of you others will let your constituents know about what they can do to help honor and support the generation.
Thank you. Okay, colleagues, members of the audience, those of you on AULIS, I'm going to walk down through the agenda so everybody knows what is happening, what is not happening. So some of you that are just hanging around might not want to stay, or some of you might want to stay. So I'm going to walk through and explain the agenda so everybody knows, and then we're going to kind of skip around a little bit on the bills that we're going to have. And SB 7, we'll be having a work session on solely for the purpose of moving that to the Rules Committee. There won't be any discussion on it other than moving to Rules Committee. There's another bill in the House that's a peer bill that we're waiting for them to do something with, but we don't want this bill to die, so it is going to another committee. 531, we're going to insert an A amendment later on. SB 707 is going to become a work group. Mr. Wilhelms in the back has agreed to serve on that with myself and several other members so we can address some of the seismic and emergency preparedness issues here in the Capitol, come to a conclusion, and hopefully have a bill for that either later this session or in February. 850, we'll have an A2 amendment put in. I will ask the governor's staff to come up and brief that one briefly in a little bit. SB 851 has a -2 amendment. It will be put into the bill, and it too will go to Rules to await another work group that's trying to come up with a resolution for that. SB 1000, we'll have a public hearing on a little bit later. SB 1054, we're planning on the -4 amendments for that a little bit later on today, and letting our colleagues then work that a little bit more on the far side. And then SB 1055, we're going to have a work session on. It has a couple of minor issues that are to debate in it, but we're going to allow the House of Representatives to deal with that, and our plan is to move it across this floor to the House of Representatives. So if you were here waiting for SB 7 or 851, again, both of those are going to Rules Committee, and SB 707 is going to be a work group, and there won't be any public testimony and hearing on that. I'm on the back page. I'm actually going to do a couple of the constituent bills first so they can leave, and the bureaucrats, like the rest of us, can stay around here. So the first work session I'm going to open is on SB 1055. If you would, counsel, and I have a couple of comments to make.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 55 was heard just last week on the 13th. It's the measure that expands the definition of deployment or deployed to include mobilization of members of armed forces, National Guard, or Reserve components in specific laws affecting certain family law judgments. It permits the court to enter a temporary order allowing or requiring reasonable visitation between a child of a deployed parent and step-parent, grandparent, or other family member related to the child. There is a minimal fiscal and no revenue impact.
And colleagues, this has been an ongoing issue. There's a little bit of debate between our lawyers, some of those in the Bar Association. This is modeled after California law that's been in place, but we're going to, the intent is to send the legal opinions we have across to our colleagues in the other committee or in the appropriate committee in the far house and let them debate this and vet this slightly farther. But our intent is to move 1055 across the floor. Madam Vice Chair.
Chair Bocus, I move Senate Bill 1055 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Madam Vice Chair, Monis Anderson moves 1055 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
And just to point out, I mean, there is some legal opinion saying that this is against the, in conflict with the United States Constitution, and
So we want to send the message that something needs to be dealt with this, and anything that we can do, the changes will be made on the House side.
Okay, thank you. And I concur with that. Any discussion? Any opposition? See no opposition. So ordered. I'll carry the bill on the floor, and we'll close the work session on 10:55. Council, are there any other constituent bills that are here?
I don't believe so, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we're going to go back to the top of the list, and we're going to open a work session solely for the purpose of moving SB 5 to the Rules Committee.
Senate Bill 7
to the Rules Committee.
Is it work session?
Work session.
Okay, Chair Boakes, I move Senate Bill 7 to the floor without recommendation, and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Finance and Revenue be rescinded, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Rules.
Madam Vice Chair, Mona Sanderson moves SB 7 to the floor without recommendation, and the subsequent referral to the Committee on Finance and Revenue be rescinded, and the bill be referred to the Committee on Rules. I do want to point something out, because we've not had a public hearing on this. We're not taking a position one way or the other on the bill. There is at least an A1 amendment that will go with it, not in the bill, but will go to the Rules Committee. And once again, I believe it's House Bill 2153 is still being worked on the far side, which is the companion bills for this. And so our purpose here is simply to move it to Rules so that the bill does not die, and we have a mechanism should they not reach an agreement in the far chamber.
And Mr. Chair, I failed to state that there was a fiscal impact and a light revenue statement because of the
system. Right. Okay. Any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. SB 7, which doesn't need a carry, it's going to Rules. Do we have paperwork on this one?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we're going to open a work session on SB 531.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 531 has a -1 amendment that replaces the original task force that was in the underlying measure with the appointment of a voluntary advisory committee by the Office of Emergency Management. Also removes staffing requirements. There is a fiscal impact on the -1 and a light, again, because of a subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means. We've been asked to recommend rescission of the subsequent referral to General Government and Accountability, because if we did that, it would kill the bill.
Okay, colleagues, this is the -1 amendment here, and this is Senator Roblin's bill. Is there anyone from OEM that wants to make a statement? He just walked out. He lost his opportunity. Madam Vice Chair.
Chair Boakes, I move to adopt the -1 amendments dated 4-17-17.
Madam Vice Chair, Mona Sanderson moves the -1 amendments dated 4-17-17. Is there any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered.
Chair Boakes, I move Senate Bill 531 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on General Government and Accountability be rescinded. So the measure as amended is referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Well, Madam, that's a big deal. Madam Vice Chair moves SB 531 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Subsequent referral to Committee on General Government Accountability is rescinded, so that the measure as amended is referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. And just for the discussion and the record here, Senator Roblin has agreed to work with this bill and the other committee and to scale it down so that they can come to some conclusion without a fiscal, but we'll let Joint Ways and Means deal with that, and we're moving it based on his recommendation. Any discussion? Any opposition? So ordered. So 531 goes to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. 707 we're not doing. Senate Bill 850. We'll open a work session with Senate Bill 850. I'll ask the governor's staff to come up so they can explain it briefly. If you would go ahead, Council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 850 was a placeholder relating to resilience planning, and we received a -2 amendment that replaces the original measure. It directs the Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Commission to create a committee or committees to assist with its work as specified, primarily to investigate issues related to the provision of earthquake insurance to residential property owners and mass care and displacement. It directs agencies with subject matter expertise to offer supplemental staff support, and it requires reports to be submitted to the State Resilience Officer by September 30th, 2018. Sunsets January 2nd, 2019, declares emergency, and takes effect on passage. We've been requested to add a subsequent referral to Rules. There was a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
Okay, and colleagues, members of the public, so we sort of got where we're at here. Task force bills are dying on the vine, and so what we're trying to do is come up with mechanisms to accomplish work with volunteers and other members and work groups. So I'm going to let somebody take the lead here, give us a brief explanation.
Chair Boulquist and members of the committee, I'm Mike Herrmann. I'm the state resilience officer in the office of Governor Kate Brown. And as a veteran, I'm honored to speak with you all today. The state resilience officer position was recommended by Senate Bill 33, an Oregon Resilient Task Force bill in September 2014, and was established in 2015 with House Bill 2270. I was confirmed by the full Senate in May 25, 2016. The National Academy of Science in 2012 describes resiliency as the ability to prepare and plan for, absorb, recover from, or more successfully adapt to an actual or potential adverse event. Oregon's area of concern is the Cascadia subduction zone, with its last complete rupture occurring in January 1700, 317 years ago. In February 2013, the Oregon Seismic Safety Policy Advisory Commission, OSPAC, presented to the 77th Legislative Assembly the Oregon Resilience Plan, as directed based on House Resolution 3, adopted in April of 2011. The Resilience Plan focused on providing legislators with information and data so that you can make investments each biennium, starting with 2013 session and continuing over the next several bienniums to build up the resiliency of the state's infrastructure. The early investments that have begun are the building blocks for future investments. But make no mistake, we still have a long road ahead to achieve our goal. ORS 401.915 provides the mission for OSPAC, and one of those critical activities is to reduce earthquake hazard. The bill with the Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 850 meets the intent. Also working with the new position of the State Resilience Officer as outlined in ORS 401.913, together can address two recommendations by OSPAC in February 2016. The first would be to address residential earthquake insurance following the modeling of the California Earthquake Authorities that has been on the books for past 20 years and is a national model. The other issue is to do a deep dive into Oregon's planning gaps on mass care, mass displacement, resulting from a Cascadia subduction zone earthquake and subsequent tsunami. This last issue was a recommendation made by OSPAC in the resiliency plan in Chapter 9, looking ahead. That time is now. This is the first major opportunity to use the governing structure of OSPAC with the executive branch focus of the resilience officer to address Cascadia subduction zone issues. And lastly, 850 is not in the governor's recommended budget, so we are neutral on the bill at this time. And I thank you for the opportunity and would answer any questions if so.
We'll let Jay go first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Vice Chair, I appreciate the opportunity to be here as the chairman of OSPAC. My name is Jay Wilson. I appreciate the Senate Bill 850 Amendment 2 has been restructured with these two items, Section 1 and 2. Speaking on behalf of our commission, we support this legislation. We look forward to the opportunity to have these two committees enacted in order to pursue our two recommendations and also demonstrating the importance and the purpose of the relationship with the state resilience officer. Just keeping my comments very brief, we look forward to taking this on and working for community resilience, as we've stated, for keeping our communities connected and intact, and looking forward to the next time that we have a chance to promote coastal development in the tsunami zone, as well as safe occupancy inspections as an institutionalized program for the state. Thank you.
And again, for the record, we've been asked to send it to rules to have some other, so there'll be another opportunity to make any improvements on it that's going there. Jeff, did you want to talk just briefly? We could give you about 3 minutes here before we take questions. Nope, plenty of chairs there. Six of one, half dozen the other. Just don't speak too loud.
Stereo. Chair Boquist, Madam Vice Chair, Mona Anderson, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Rubin. I'm a local emergency manager. I do not speak specifically for my agency. I am a former vice chair of the State Resilience Task Force the governor appointed to implement the resilience plan. And I'll say for the outset that I'm all in favor of trying to get away with the voluntary one-year task forces. We tend to focus on there are four big R's when it comes to disaster response. We tend to focus on the response piece. This bill gives us a chance to look at the recovery, restoration, and resilience from the insurance side, just economic survival. And the rest of it, the whole idea of the bill is what happens after response. About 5 years ago, the State Public Health Division came up with their strategic work plan for emergency preparedness, and one of their goals, mass care, their capability 7, addressed determining public health roles and mass care operations, determining mass care needs of impacted populations, coordinating public health, medical, and mental health mass care services, and monitoring mass care population health. That's the big four. Those are really critical functions, and it demonstrates how much of a role OHA and Public Health Division and other portions of OHA can play. We know what happens to populations, particularly vulnerable ones in disasters. If you're already on the margins, you're going to be even more vulnerable. But we know that even people who are doing pretty well when they're isolated from health care or when they lose their shelter, they're going to be in bad shape. 2015 report from the Institute of Medicine on Healthy, Resilient, Sustainable Communities after Disaster looked at integrating health considerations into recovery, leveraging recovery resources to achieve healthier post-disaster communities, developing integrated social services recovery frameworks, all intending to get more healthy post-disaster communities. This is not the ideal way to do it. We tried in the last long session to get a longer work time with funding, but given the options, this bill gives us the best path forward of the options presented to us. So I think we should go with that. It's a lot to do in 12 months, but we have a network that we didn't have with the combination of OSPAC and the State Resilience Officer. So I thank you for your time.
And colleagues, I appreciate your all three of your input. I think there's a couple minor paperwork glitches, so we are going to set it to rules, so you may have another opportunity. I sit on rules, and so shouldn't be a problem there. I just do want to point out, and I understand the 12 months is there, but I think there's become a realization really over the last 18 months just how far behind we are. I know Jay has been preaching this for years, how far behind we are, and I think we've heard you preach it before, and now suddenly everybody's saying, hey, guess what, we're behind, and now we need to do something. And so that's sort of where we are right now. Any other questions?
Not a question, Mr. Chair. There may be some confusion. It wasn't Senate Bill 850 with the request to be sent to the rules.
Subsequent.
My apologies. The
okay.
request to send to rules is for Senate Bill 851.
Which we already knew.
Yes. So my apologies.
So we're going to the floor, Madam Chair. Tomorrow morning, of course.
So 850 is going to the floor.
850 is going
yeah,
to the
floor.
Not to
rules. 851. Yeah. My apologies to the speakers as well.
Okay.
That's just an error in my notes.
Other questions? There's no questions. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it very much. Madam Vice Chair, we are in.
Okay, yes. Chair Boquist, I move to adopt the dash twos, right? Okay. The dash two amendments dated 4/14/17.
Madam Vice Chair Monis Anderson moves the dash two amendments dated 4/14/17 into SB 850. Is there discussion? Is there opposition? Seeing none, so ordered.
Chair Boquist, I move Senate Bill 850 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Monis Anderson moves the 850, SB 850, as amended with the dash twos to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Is there opposition? Seeing none, so ordered. I'll carry it. And with that, we're going to close the work session on 850 and open a work session on SB 851, which is the bill that's going to rules.
My apologies, Mr. That's Chair, right. Members of the committee. Senate Bill 851 is a placeholder relating to the Oregon Military Department that was language was replaced with a dash one and dash two amendment. The dash one amendment is incorporated into the dash two, which changes one word from shall to may. The underlying the amendment allows the Oregon Military Department, forgive me, to receive terrorist threat information for threat management purposes. This is the measure that we've been asked to send to rules. It has a fiscal impact and no revenue impact.
And colleagues, just so you know, the governor's staff, legislative staff, and the other executive branch, the attorney general's staff, are working on this issue, which is why we're sending it to rules. Madam Vice Chair.
Boquist, and it's the dash twos, correct?
Yep.
I move to adopt the dash two amendments dated 4/18/17.
Madam Vice Chair, Monis Anderson moves to adopt the Dash 2 amendment stated 41817 to SB 851. Is there discussion? Is there opposition? Seeing none, so ordered. Madam Vice Chair.
Chair Boquist, I move Senate Bill 851 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Rules.
Madam Vice Chair, Monis Anderson moves SB 851 as amended with the Dash 2 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. The bill be referred to the Committee on Rules. Is there discussion? The opposition, seeing none, so ordered. 851 goes to rules, which I sit on too. With that, we're going to close the work session on SB 851, and we're going to open a work session on SB 1054. If you would please, counsel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1054 was previously heard on April 13th, last week. It exempts hospitals reimbursed by the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs from requirement to obtain certificate of need from Oregon Health Authority prior to expanding capacity to provide inpatient psychiatric and chemical dependency services. Sunsets 2 years after its effective date, declares an emergency, is effective on passage. We have a Dash 4 amendment, which is the previous amendments were all an iteration that evolved into the Dash 4. It refines the language to dedicate the increased capacity to serve covered active duty personnel, veterans, and their dependents for at least 8 years, and it makes the exemption available for 2 rather than sunsetting it. It repeals the 31st of December, 2028.
And colleagues, the intent that we're doing, I'm going to allow Felicia to talk to press some information, is to send this across the floor to the House so that we can work on this issue on the far side. We have been at war since 2003, most of us, in the major invasion in Iraq. We've had 12 years I've been in the legislature to address mental health care issues. We haven't made it more than about 2 inches in 12 years, and so patience is wearing thin, and opportunities, when they present themselves, we're going to try and at least get our colleagues across the House to discuss them, too. And with that, I'm going to give Felicia an opportunity, because she asked.
Senator Boquist, members of the committee, thank you. We are, I would say, happy with the direction where Senate Bill 1054 is headed. We still have some concerns about how the language is written to make sure that the extra capacity actually is dedicated to dependents and their families before giving people the opt-out of the certificate of need process. We also think that the way the bill is written actually may put restrictions on current hospitals from expanding their current mental health care capacity for folks outside of veterans and their dependents. And so we want to make sure that if facilities currently want to expand capacity, they should be able to expand capacity, that veterans should have crack at those beds first. And so we'll be happy to introduce amendments on the House side to help address some of these issues. But I think that we're much happier with where the bill's going and excited to work on the House side with Senator Boquist and the rest of the committee.
And for the record, we wholeheartedly agree with you. We don't want to lose any capacity whatsoever, and we want to encourage new dedicated capacity, which is exactly the intent of the bill and the direction we're trying to go. The success or failure in the House is yet to be determined, but I think the clear message from the committee is that we have to make progress. We have to start talking about it, stop studying it, and start making progress. Madam Vice Chair.
Yeah, you know that Oregon ranks 49th out of the 50 states in caring for mental health, and this is extremely troubling. I truly believe our mental health system is broken, and mental health issues, it's not just veterans. It knows no class. It knows no gender, age, ethnicity, veterans, non-veterans, but it is troubling that our veterans who have been defending our nation have protected us, have been in very dangerous situations, and we're letting them and other Oregonians down because we don't have a system that's really able to take care of them. Yeah. So I like the direction of starting with just veterans because it's... We have a certificate of need. I believe in the certificate of need. But if this is narrowed to just veterans, we will see how it survives. It certainly doesn't solve our state's broken system, but it possibly could have a huge benefit for our veterans. I am more concerned about a facility being located in Roseburg or Coos Bay or Bend rather than the metro area, since although the VA hospital is not addressing mental health issues very well at all. I would like to have OHA and the VA convene NAMI and the Hospital Association and others to really work on developing a system-wide change to our behavioral health system. And in that way, I think we can maybe improve access and keep patients in the right level of care in their communities. And I would hope, and I don't know if we can mandate them to do this, since that's not what the bill is doing it, but it would like to have a report on the progress or in my Senate Healthcare Committee in the interim days, because we really can't do anything. We can't do anything. It's time to make systematic changes and really improve our behavioral health system. But I know that the Hospital Association, I know NAMI, and if we can get OHA and VA together, maybe they can come up with a system that can really address our VA or our veterans' mental health issues much bit more than what they're doing right now. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And thank you, Madam Vice Chair. And the Senate has seen its share of this particular issue. And so I suppose our patience is running out, and we appreciate your offer to help. Thank you. Madam Vice Chair, we're in work session.
Okay. Chair Boquist, I move to adopt the Dash 4 amendments, dated 4-17-17.
Madam Vice Chair, Monis Anderson moves the Dash 4 amendments, dated 4-17-17, into SB 1054. Is there discussion? Is there opposition? Seeing none, so ordered. Madam Vice Chair.
Chair Boquist, I move Senate Bill 1054 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Madam Vice Chair, Monis Anderson moves SB 1054 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Opposition? Seeing none, so ordered. We'll carry it. You want to co-carry? The Vice Chair and I will co-carry. We'll decide later who opens and closes. But this is a raw issue. So with that, we're going to close the work session, SB 1054. And we have one item, which we're going to open a public hearing on, SB 1000. We do have people signed up to testify, I believe. And Council, if you would, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1000 was previously heard on March 30th, and we have a couple of amendments since then. This is the measure which authorizes the creation of a volunteer civil defense force under the Department of State Police called the Oregon State Police Civil Defense Force. It describes its function. It requires its volunteers and volunteers with county civil defense forces to possess certain qualifications. It distinguishes it from the existing Oregon State Police Civil Defense Force from the Oregon State Defense Force and renames the Oregon State Defense Force the Oregon Civil Defense Force. There was a request from LFO to add a subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means because of the Dash 1 amendment. We have a Dash 1 and a Dash 2. The Dash 1 provides that reserve officers may also volunteer or participate in the Civil Defense Force and permits them, if they are veterans, to seek reimbursement for training from the Department of Veterans Affairs. The Dash 2 amendment reinforces a voluntary nature of participation in the Defense Force by refining language that insulates public bodies from tort liability.
And colleagues, the Dash 1 amendment actually is from the House Veterans and Emergency Preparedness Committee, where it came from. And really what we're doing is renaming the State Defense Force that's been sort of on hold for a little bit of a while and expanding that authority. And we have two individuals that say they're against it, which I'm perfectly fine. Eric Polson and Jack Fidla.
Yes.
Come on, please.
Senator Boquist, members of the committee, thank you very much for taking the time to hear me. I'm going to just simply read this statement, and I will probably add some comments to it at the end. Imagine for a moment that the Cascadia subduction zone has ruptured.
He did say his name before he sat down.
Oh, did you say your name?
He said his name, all right.
I'm sorry, what?
I didn't hear your name. I'm
sorry. Oh, my name is Eric Polson.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Eric.
A massive 9.3 earthquake has devastated the North California coast, the Oregon coast, the Washington coast. Significant damage has made its way all the way to the foothills of the Cascade Mountains. The coastal areas of all three states have been reduced to pockets of survivors, isolated from each other by destroyed roadways along the coast. Most, if not all, of these pockets are now isolated from any assistance from further inside the states, by impassable or destroyed arterial roadways away from the coast. As we emerge from the initial shock of the utter and complete destruction, we start looking to our emergency management agencies to start getting help to assist as many as can be helped and save as many lives as are possible in the face of such devastation. Professional and volunteer organizations and groups start to mobilize as many of their members as can be freed from their own devastation. Calls for support and assistance start going out to neighboring states within hours of the last shaking of the initial quake. What initially emerges is a patchwork of groups with little initial coordination, simply trying to help as many people as they can get to. Eventually, as more and more volunteers arise, a level of organization appears. Initially, as they acquire sufficient managing, Initially, as they acquire sufficient manning, emergency operations centers in the western part of the state become active and within a reasonable amount of time as possible, fully functional. As information starts to arrive, a picture starts to emerge of the level of devastation. Within a hopefully reasonable amount of time, professional emergency services are able to mobilize and start responding to the direst of needs. Unfortunately, these emergency services are going to be completely overwhelmed for longer than would seem reasonably acceptable. That will have to become the norm in an incident of this magnitude. As the emergency operations centers develop a picture of the incident, they forward it through whatever means are available to the Emergency Coordination Center in Salem. The ECC will be completely overwhelmed for some time to come and may very well have to be increasingly selective of the information it receives. Eventually, the ECC and the Joint Operations Center of the Oregon Military Department will become adequately manned to provide the support the EOCs are looking for. Few, if any, of the local EOCs will be able to activate and deploy sufficient equipment and or personnel for the task at hand. The need to augment the local resources with state resources will become apparent very early in the disaster. As most of the normal venues of communications will have been destroyed or rendered untenable within moments of the earthquake, ham operators will become the immediate and indispensable resource. For a considerable time, hams will likely be the only source of communications and information. Now the need for military assets emerges. Some of the needs will be self-evident, but there will be many that must be determined as information emerges. As this information emerges, it must be consolidated and forwarded to the Emergency Coordination Center. Until a specific need has been determined, that need will have to be determined sometime after it has reached the ECC and been forwarded to the JOC or the Joint Operations Center. The possibility for hours to have passed between the initial determination for such a need and having been satisfied through the formal request, mobilization, and deployment is very real. In a disaster of this magnitude, it is highly likely that many lives will be lost in the time it takes to get the military assets on scene. Now, imagine the repercussions if you found out that there had once existed an organization within the state that had trained and practiced to provide a venue whereby military assets could potentially have been available and reach their destination significantly quicker. Would you consider that an acceptable solution in a disaster? The mission of the ORSDF at its disbanding. The mission of the ORSDF was intended to have been to serve as liaison officers to each unit's respective emergency operations center. The plan was that each liaison officer team would consist of at least one radio operator, one recorder, and if sufficient personnel were available, a single liaison officer. The liaison officer would be in close proximity and contact with the incident commander and would provide incident status information to the Joint Operations Center. In addition, should the incident need them and the incident commander determine that the request was appropriate, the liaison officer could provide information to the Joint Operations Center on military asset requests that would be forthcoming. The JOC could then monitor the incident and determine if military assets were being requested, the best location from which to draw the assets, and which assets would be appropriate based on their situational awareness. The concept was that as it could take hours for an asset request to clear through the EOC and the ECC in Salem, the asset could be mobilized and potentially staged awaiting the formal request to clear. This could save, in some cases, the hours that it would take, that would be consumed by the mobilization process prior to the arrival of the formal request, and potentially countless lives. The reason for disbanding of the RSDF, I do not know. The stated reason was an unexpected liability to the state that the military department was ill-suited to bear based on a single accident of an RSDF member while traveling to a semi-annual training event in Camp Rialia. This wound up being a severe injury and required significant medical treatment. Experience and participation. The ORSDF had numerous, not insignificant, successes and exposure by its members. Members provided communication services during the Vernonia floods, short notice and remote communications during such national exercises as Vital Connections, in addition to other state and local exercises and drills. In all cases, the ORSDF was recognized for their ability to provide professional level and accurate communication services. In a training session provided at the JOC, members of the ORSDF received specific recognition for their ability to closely integrate with military members in a disaster simulation. There were other successes that received recognition and praise from professionals within the emergency management emergency management community. Some questions of interest. What was the real driving reason behind the disbanding of the ORSDF? Will this bill provide a structure that will adequately replace the liaison function the ORSDF was intended to provide? Will the state police have an adequate need and or purpose for such an organization? Will the various state sheriffs have a need and or purpose for such an organization, as they already have significant communication infrastructure through ARES and RACES? Moving forward, the original mission was a very viable mission. Many members of the ORSDF spent countless hours training, practicing, and drilling for the operation. A significant number of members of the ORSDF were extremely well-qualified ham radio operators, some with actual emergency communications and support experience. Some of the former members attended extensive and numerous training courses and sessions to further their training well beyond the basic requirements for their positions. The ORSDF had at least two fully qualified and endorsed communication sections leader from within the incident command structure system. This is not an insignificant distinction for an organization of this type. If the ORSDF is to succeed in a mission, the following should be considerations in its reestablishment. The command structure should be completely reestablished. It should consider only qualified personnel for the mission and personnel that have a complete buy-in and belief in the mission. Greater support must be given by the Oregon Military Department. This support is essential to the success of the ORSDF. Greater integration with the host unit in the various armories must be achieved. Some of the previous members achieved some level of integration with, while others did not. This cannot be the case moving forward. Each hosting armory must be made aware of the mission of the unit being hosted and should be encouraged to utilize the capabilities of the unit whenever practicable. An introduction of the mission must be provided to each of the emergency operations centers that will be served by the ORSDF. This must be done in the form of a formal introduction by the Oregon Military Department. This will encourage the emergency managers to more closely integrate the liaison officer teams into their activities. The Oregon Military Department should be more involved in the training sessions and activities of the units of the ORSDF. This does not have to be financial support, as facility support is adequate when a large-scale training event is planned. Some comments that I would like to add to my testimony. The Oregon State Defense Force consisted of many MARS members as well, Military Affiliated Radio System. These are members that not only work with the Oregon State Defense Force, but also within the MARS network to provide an expanded capability. Imagine for a moment that you're a ham radio operator. All hell has broken loose. You're trying to find a frequency on a radio that you can get through to somebody else. But there are so many people on the radio that it is nearly impossible to find a frequency. As a MARS member, I can access military radio frequencies that will have little or no use on them at all. That gives me the opportunity to get information from one point to another unencumbered. The last thing that I would like to mention is that many of the former Oregon State Defense Force members are deeply concerned about this bill, as it appears on the surface that the intent of this bill is to wipe out any possibility for the Oregon State Defense Force to return as it was. I have clearly stated what the mission of the Oregon State Defense Force was. We drilled, we worked, we practiced very hard to accomplish that mission. I think that moving forward, some effort should be made into reestablishing the Oregon State Defense Force as it was, because this is a function that nothing else can replace. The Oregon Military Department, on the first or second Wednesday of every month, has a radio check-in. The military department is trying to tell people that we have a communications infrastructure in place to replace the Oregon State Defense Force. For many years, I also participated in the National Guard Net. The norm was for 3 to maybe 5 of the 36 armories to actually check in. The last time that I am aware of this net having been run, they had 6 armories check in. Now, if you think that that is an adequate communications infrastructure for a statewide emergency, then the military department is ready. If not, then I would submit to you that the Oregon State Defense Force was the only entity that was prepared to take the mantle of this job.
Jack?
We talked a lot about veterans today, and this organization, the Oregon State Defense Force, is an excellent place to send those veterans, to give them the camaraderie and get to wear the uniform again, go to drills, and practice their skills that they learned in the military. And we can use that training in the State Defense Force, and we have used it. And to just push it aside and tell them to go wear a pink polo shirt to the next meeting, it's not going to happen. These people want to wear the uniform, be a part of a unit, and be a part of a structure that may save lives in the future. Thank you.
One of the challenges that we face, interestingly enough, as you pointed out, is there's a lot of volunteers who want to volunteer and now no place to go. Mm-hmm. And the intent of the bill is to leave it if, because this is a legislature, we can't make the governor go reinstitute everything that you gentlemen outlined. We just don't have that authority or power. But what we do know is the state police have expressed interest in the radio capabilities you have, because it's a fine radio capability. In addition to that, we've had county sheriffs express interest in some of those capabilities too. So the dilemma that we face is, do we let it stay as is, which you know what that is right now, mm-hmm. or do we at least provide the opportunity for the state police to try and pick up some of those volunteers and the county sheriffs to pick up some of those volunteers who are veterans who want to serve again? That's the level we face. At our level, we're not in the position to say, you got to go do this, you got to reinstate that, so on and so forth. It's already on the books. And so that's sort of where we're at. Okay. Do we provide a position so that there is an opportunity for individuals to volunteer? And we're hopefully, you know, everybody here knows we're not prepared for communication. So that's sort of where we are. So the goal is to leave the military department position to whatever they do in the executive branch, but provide that opportunity to the county sheriffs. So any thoughts on that?
Well, I suppose that at some level my hope was to raise awareness of the absurdity of the disbanding of the Oregon State Defense Force. I was at the hearing for the House bill that did so. Unfortunately, I was very ill prepared at that time for any testimony. I was notified on too short a notice to prepare any testimony for that bill. There seems to have been some politics involved in the whole thing, and I'm not going to get into that. But my hope was to raise the awareness of this vital function that is now not available to the state of Oregon. And as I mentioned, and I'm sure all of you can well imagine, the process of starting a request for assets has to go through the local EOC to the ECC in Salem and then eventually to the military department. The military department has absolutely no awareness that this is coming until they receive it. Our hope was to provide them at least a little bit of notice that, hey, this is what has happened. This is the assets that the incident commander says they need to resolve this, and a request for those assets is coming. When you're in a... I've been in some pretty dicey situations where immediate action was the only action that was going to save lives. If a request had to go a circuitous route, lives would have been lost. If I had a way to provide a direct venue for that request, and then somebody came along and yanked it out from under me for whatever reason. Their stated reason was that the military department could not absorb the liability. I was in the State Defense Force for, what, about 12, 13 years total before it was disbanded. In that entire time, I have personal knowledge of two incidents where the state either did or could have become liable. One was a vehicle accident while a member was being called up to a drill. It's understandable. He's under orders. So the state assumes that responsibility. The second example is a little more personal to me. I was on orders. I live in Forest Grove. I was on orders to Salem to work with the unit to develop or to provide communications training for that unit. After lunch, I started to develop symptoms that to me felt like a cardiac incident. And they were not abating. They were getting more serious. So the commanding officer of the unit said, go to the hospital. You need to get to the hospital right now. It turned out to be something entirely non-related to a cardiac incident. However, I was under orders at that time. The State Accident Insurance Fund denied my claim, even though the circumstances were identical. I was under orders providing services that were required for my mission. They denied the claim. So the whole idea of the military department not being able to absorb the liability, to me, became a preposterous excuse based on my personal experience. So there were obviously deeper issues. I have no idea what they were. I have heard discussions about them, but that's not a matter for this hearing. My purpose in coming here was to try and reinvigorate the understanding and need for the mission that the Oregon State Defense Force was providing.
Well, we appreciate your testimony. Any comments or questions? I mean, the situation we have is that especially the two chairs of the committee realized that not only did we go to Vernonia once with a ham radio operator because we couldn't communicate, we went three times. Mm-hmm. We didn't learn anything in 30 years.
Yeah.
I think you heard earlier, we start talking, everybody says, we're going to fix something next week and next month and so on and so forth. And so what we're trying to do is, before all the volunteers completely disappear, is at least provide an opportunity, this particular bill, the way it's structured, if they invigorate it and restart the force in Salem, the statute stays the same the way it is. It changes the name so that it's not State Defense Force to Civil Defense Force. But it allows the opportunity for the sheriffs and the state police who understand the lack of communications. As you know, there are many troopers in our rural communities that it doesn't matter what kind of high-speed radio they have no communications. Mm-hmm. They can't reach anybody. They're out there completely by themselves. And to provide those assets out there, which is the intent of the bill. If there's no questions, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. There are three versions of this, colleagues. One of them is the base bill, which has no fiscal and everything, which would go to the House. It's the House of Representatives has one of the amendments that they'd like to work on their side. So it's sort of our decision what we want to do.
State again what the ones and the twos are.
Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee, the dash one is from the House sides. It provides that reserve officers who also volunteer and participate in the Civil Defense Force might seek reimbursement for the training as if they're veterans from the Department of Veterans Affairs. That's the amendment that adds a fiscal and would therefore request a subsequent referral to Joint Ways and Means. The Dash 2 amendment does not have a fiscal or a revenue impact. There's no request for that to go to Joint Ways and Means, and that the Dash 2 reinforces the voluntary nature of participation, which the gentleman was just speaking to, by tweaking some of the language, refining language that insulates public bodies from tort liability.
Any discussion, colleagues?
Do we have a fiscal on the Dash 1s?
On the Dash 1. And if that is moved into the measure, the Dash 1 provides reserve officers an opportunity to seek reimbursement from ODVA if they are veterans who go through the training.
And the Dash 1s is the House side. Our other option is to send it either as the original bill, do nothing, send it as the original bill, or put the Dash 1, which clarifies liability, which I think probably we need to do, and then send it to the House. And if the House then wants to discuss a fiscal with the Joint Ways and Means, they can do that. Or do nothing. So, yeah. My preference would be to, at this point, is adopt a dash two to clear the liability, allow the volunteers to volunteer if they want to volunteer, and then if the House wants to then take action in terms of discussion with Ways and Means.
I would tend to agree.
Okay. We're going to open a public, or close the public hearing and open a work session on SB 1000.
Boquist, I move to adopt the dash two amendments dated 4/13/17.
Madam Vice Chair, Montes Anderson adopts the dash two amendments dated 4/13/17 to SB 1000. Discussion. Opposition, seeing none, so ordered.
Chair Boquist, I move Senate Bill 1000 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Actually, we don't do that. We don't.
Oh, no. As amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Right. Madam Chair, Montes Anderson moves SB 1000 adopted by the dash twos to the floor with a due pass recommendation. The discussion? For opposition, seeing none, so ordered. I will explain it on the floor, and then we will let our House colleagues determine what they want to do with their amendments.
And before you adjourn,
I'm going to close the work session SB 1000, Madam Vice Chair.
I just want to make sure that we had all the paperwork for the bills. That we weren't supposed to suspend the rules for anything. I mean, everything was copacetic. I mean,
Mr.
as
Chair,
errors
Madam
have been
Vice
made,
Chair,
I get so nervous.
We indeed had everything, all of the proper paperwork.
Great.
For then revenues for every bill that was moved today, and they're all postponed.
Copacetic.
And SB 7 is to rules, and SB 851 is to rules, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you. All right, colleagues, we're at the end of our first session deadline, so have a good afternoon.
Do we have a meeting on Thursday?
No, Mr. Chair.
No meeting on Thursday.
Okay.
Where did you come up with the word?
Okay.